4. HMS Chihiro, 50, Garath Bay, Kingdom of Dolar.
My son, you should sit down and count to 1,000 slowly. If not in the interest of your spiritual serenity, in the interest of avoiding apoplexy.
Earl Thirsk's head whipped around. Had the speaker been anyone besides Stiffen Mike, the Earl's response would probably have been both pungent and profane. Under the circumstances, however, both those options were denied him, although he couldn't quite keep the heat out of his gaze. Mike simply gazed at him serenely, and after a moment, Thirsk felt his own lips twitch unwillingly. After all, the bishop had a point.
"Seriously, Lewis," Mike said, pointing at the Earl's desk chair. "Stop pacing around like a slash lizard with its tail cut off. I understand exactly why you're so furious, but in the long run, I think this may actually work out in our favor."
Thirsk blinked in surprise. He looked at the bishop for several seconds, then walked slowly around the desk, seated himself as directed, and cocked his head. "I would be very interested to hear how you reached that conclusion, my lord," he said politely.
"Think about it," Mike replied. "They've done exactly what you predicted, and they got away with it because neither Thorast nor the Harchongese did what you've been recommending for months. So the Carizians now have their forward bases, exactly where you said they'd want them. For that matter, exactly where you told Thorast they'd put them after you got the governor of Quiraz's dispatch. And I don't doubt they're going to make their presence very unpleasantly felt, which in turn is going to increase the pressure on you and on me once Chancellor Trenaire and his colleagues..."
Mike was far too cautious to use the term the Group of Four, even with someone he'd come to trust as much as he trusted Thirsk.
"Hear about this. Agreed?"
"Oh, I can safely say I concur with that much," Thirsk said, and the bishop shrugged.
"Well, when they start screaming at you to do something, anything, I, for one, am going to point out to them, quite forcefully, that if they'd listened to you in the beginning, you wouldn't have to do the aforesaid something, anything, to get their arses out of the crack they've wedged themselves so tightly into."
Thirsk's eyebrows rose. He and Mike had found themselves working more and more closely together, and his respect for the Schulerite had grown steadily. He had to admit that his willingness to trust Mike had taken a severe blow, as the reports coming out of the temple had mounted, however. He knew perfectly well that Mike hadn't had a thing to do with that madness, but the bishop was a Schulerite, and Thirsk had found that hard to forgive. "Probably because I spent so much time under official displeasure myself after Crag Reach," he thought now. "For a while there, I was fairly certain Fern was going to hand me over to either Thorast or the Inquisition as the kingdom's scapegoat. So I suppose I've got a better feel for the sheer cynicism involved in all this. But to think that even Clintan would go this far, just slaughtering so many of his fellow vicars and so many bishops and archbishops, would have been bad enough, especially this way. But their families? Madness." He knew he wasn't the only Dolaran who felt that way, although very few of those who did were stupid enough to say so. And he suspected Bishop Stiffen came very close to sharing his own feelings. On the other hand, Clintan had made his point crystal clear. Treachery would be punished as severely as heresy, and anything short of complete and total loyalty was, by definition, treachery. "And I don't doubt military defeat will be defined as treachery, too," he thought grimly. "Especially if someone's been unfortunate enough to have suffered defeat once before. I suppose I should think of it as an additional incentive to do well." That last thought woke at least a flicker of amusement, and he was grateful for it. Humorous thoughts had been hard to come by lately. "I hadn't thought of it from exactly that perspective, my lord," he said with a wintry smile. "My previous experience with being right when everyone else was wrong hasn't precisely filled me with boundless confidence in how they're going to react when it all happens again. My observation is that powerful men get even more vengeful if you insist on proving they're always wrong.
Ah, but this time, you're going to keep your mouth shut. You're not going to say one word about Claw Island or Trove Island. You're just going to provide your normal, well-reasoned, cogent arguments about how we should respond. I'll rub all the salt into the wounds. At least something good should come of...
The bishop paused suddenly. For an instant his mouth tightened, then he shrugged.
At least something good should come of your being right yet again, he finished.
Thirsk nodded silently, but his eyes were very intent. He knew what Mike had started to say, though it was the closest he'd yet come to anything which could be construed as remotely critical of the head of his own order. Yet there was a certain grim truth to it, Thirsk reflected. After Clinton's brutal demonstration, no layman, and precious few bishops or archbishops, were going to so much as look like they were arguing with a Schulerite bishop. I hope you're right about that, my lord, Thirsk said, addressing what the bishop had said rather than what he had not said. Their eyes met, and he saw the understanding in Mike's gaze. Then the bishop shook himself.
So, what do you recommend? He asked.
Actually, my lord, if you're serious about the latitude I'm likely to enjoy, I think we may be able to turn this into an opportunity as well as a problem.
Indeed. Mike's eyes narrowed. How so?
Well, I don't doubt the Carizians are going to raise Shan Wei's own hell with our coastal shipping, Thirsk said frankly. The escorts I've been attaching to the local convoys have been enough to encourage privateers, even Carizian ones, to go hunting elsewhere. Of course, I have to admit that having the temple lean on the governor of Shui didn't exactly hurt either.
The Earl grimaced.
Distance is our best protection against privateers, to be honest, as long as there's no local port where they can dispose of their prizes. This is a naval squadron, though. Unless they come across something extraordinarily valuable to their war effort, they're not going to care about getting prizes home for disposal. They're going to be sinking and burning anything they can take, and their galleons are powerful enough to brush aside my escorts. Or perhaps I should say my present escorts.
He paused, and Mike pursed his lips, then his eyebrows arched.
You're thinking about the training opportunity, aren't you, my lord?
There was a note of respect in his voice, and Thirsk shrugged.
If I were commanding this little expedition, he said, I'd have several objectives in mind. I'd want to do everything I could to hamper our naval buildup, which would mean coming as close as possible to shutting down our coastal traffic. I'd want to draw as much as possible of our attention to my activities here, in order to discourage us from planning more offensive actions of our own somewhere else. And I'd want to prune back our strength. I'd want to suck Dolaran and possibly Harchongi's galleys and galleons into combat with my galleons on my terms, so I could defeat them in detail and whittle them down. And frankly, I'd want to impress on those inexperienced Dolarans and Harchongi's the fact that they really, truly don't want to confront Carizian seamen on blue water.
Mike was nodding, and Thirsk shrugged.
Well, I'm not ready to take the ships we have off to Trove Island, or even worse, Claw Island, to try to take it back. The best estimate we've got right now is that they have somewhere between 15 and 20 galleons, and we have less than half our projected strength actually in commission.
He shrugged again.
Oh, we've got 43 theoretically ready for sea, but only about 30 have crews I'd consider fully worked up. And let's be honest, even with all the training we've been able to give them, they're not going to be the equal of Carizian crews, not yet. So, if they've got 20 galleons, they'd probably still have the advantage against 30 of ours. I wouldn't be surprised if at least part of their thinking in taking the islands isn't a hope of drawing us into action in an effort to retake them.
I hadn't thought about it that way, the bishop mused. Take something we need to take back, then wait for us to come to them on their terms, you mean?
Something like that, yes, Thirsk nodded. But if we decline to do that, they'll simply go ahead and begin raiding our shipping. At that point, they'll discover we're using convoys, and they won't be able to cover enough water just to locate something as elusive as a convoy unless they split up their own strength. I doubt their admiral's going to be willing to send out anything much smaller than 4 or 5 galleons, with 1 or 2 of their schooners to scout for them, even so. I wish he'd be that foolish, give us the opportunity to do the pouncing and the defeating in detail, but I doubt he will. On the other hand, he will have to come to us to raid our shipping. In that sense, the convoys are lodestones. They'll attract the Carizians, and the Carizians are a long way from home. I'm sure they brought a lot of naval stores, replacement canvas, extra spars, things like that, with them. But that's not remotely the same as having dockyard support. The same thing holds true for their manpower. What they have with them is all they're going to have. So even if the loss rate in an engagement is in their favor, strategically, it will be in our favor, because we can make our losses good. And let's face it, in the long term, every ship Karis loses is going to hurt the Carizians worse than losing the same ship would hurt us, because, ultimately, our resources are so much deeper than theirs.
So you're saying this is an opportunity to grind them down?
Yes, it is. And even more importantly, if we do this the right way, we'll have the opportunity to blood some of our ship's companies. If our convoy escorts are strong enough to beat off a few attacks, even if we lose some merchant ships, or even a war galleon or two, the warships we don't lose will be steadily gaining experience and confidence. As long as we don't simply get our arses kicked up between our ears, of course.
Oh, of course.
Mike smiled, then leaned back while he thought. He stayed that way for several moments, then inhaled sharply and nodded.
I understand your points, Lewis, and I think they're all good ones. You'll certainly have my support with Duke Thorast, and if necessary, with Duke Fern as well. Of course, if it turns out that they don't cooperate with you, we'll have to think of something else.
He grimaced.
Doing nothing, unfortunately, is not an option.
Nor should it be, Thirsk agreed. Obviously, I don't think I'm wrong, but the possibility always exists. And if, as you say, they decline to cooperate with me, I'll just have to come up with something to change their minds, won't I?
5. HMS Squall 36, Hanky Sound, Kingdom of Dolar.
Stand by the starboard battery!
Captain Arnold Stewart watched the gap of gray-green water narrow as HMS Squall drove hard to the north-northeast, closing in on the Harchongese coaster. The small, lubberly fugitive had done its limping best to stay away from Squall when she and her consorts swooped down on the straggling cluster of brigs and sloops, but there'd never been much chance of that. The tubby little brig trying to evade destruction was less than half Squall's size, with a correspondingly smaller sail plan, and far less ability to carry sail in blustery conditions.
And blustery, Stewart thought, pretty much sums up the day, doesn't it, Arnold?
Not that he had any urge to complain. The wind had risen steadily since dawn. By now it was blowing a stiff topsail breeze out of the southwest, with wind speeds approaching 30 miles per hour and 10-foot waves. Squall was leaning heavily to the quartering wind, foaming towards her prey on the larboard tack, and she was making good just under 9 knots. The poor little brig was making 6 at best, and her desperate break for shallow water had come too late. Besides, Squall was one of the ICN's converted merchantmen. She drew little more than 2/3 as much water as a proper war galleon like Admiral Manthir's flagship. Stewart could see the merchant ship's captain standing by the taffrail, staring helplessly at the oncoming galleon, and wondered what was going through the other man's mind. Ships like the runty little coaster tended to be family affairs, with small crews who were mostly related to each other. There wouldn't be more than 10 or 12 men aboard her, 15 at the most, and a single accurate broadside from squall would reduce her to a wrecked slaughterhouse. Her skipper had to know that, too. In fact, Stuart was more than a little surprised the man hadn't already hauled down his church pennant and hove to. "Probably has something to do with the reports coming out of Zion," he thought grimly. "If Glinton's willing to do that to vicars and archbishops, God only knows what he'd do to some poor bastard of a merchant captain for surrendering too quickly." Arnold Stuart wasn't the sort to waste a lot of pity on the enemies of his empire and his church, yet he couldn't avoid a sort of disgusted compassion for the captain he was overtaking. The disgust wasn't for the hapless seaman, either. "Well, I'll sympathize with him all day long, but I'll also send his sorry ragged arse to the Krakens, along with all his friends and relations, if he doesn't haul his wind pretty damned quick," the captain told himself testily, and raised the leather speaking trumpet in his right hand. "Master Malden!"
"Aye, sir."
Lieutenant James Malden, Squall's tall, thin first lieutenant, was well forward, standing beside the starboard chaser with his reddish-brown hair blowing in the wind. Now he looked back at his commanding officer, and Stuart pointed at the brig with his free hand.
"Encourage that fellow to see reason, Master Malden."
"Aye, aye, sir."
Stuart could see Malden's huge white grin all the way from the quarterdeck, and the lanky lieutenant bent over the 14-pounder's breech. He fussed for a moment, waving hand commands while the gun captain stood to one side, arms crossed, watching with a sort of resigned amusement. Despite the fact that Malden was the officer responsible for ensuring the discipline of the ship's company, and his notion of appropriate punishment could be stiff, he'd always been popular with the men. Probably because he was ruthlessly equitable in the penalties he awarded. It was well known, however, that he'd always really wanted to be a gunner. He was fanatical about gun drill, insisting that every crew ought to consist solely of qualified gun captains, and he took every opportunity to work one of the guns himself. Which meant the gun captain he'd so carefully trained got to stand there, watching the first lieutenant play. Now Malden took one more look along the barrel, waved the rest of the crew back, took tension in the firing lanyard, waited for exactly the right moment in Squall's movement, and pulled. The 14-pounder bellowed, gun truck squealing as it recoiled across the planking, until the breaching ropes brought it up short. A huge gush of flame-cored smoke belched from the muzzle, and Stuart's eyebrows rose as the very first shot scored a direct hit. The round shot punched through the brig's bulwark, slammed into the boat stowed atop the main hatch, tearing it in half and sending splinters hissing, then punched through the opposite bulwark and plunged into the sea, well beyond the merchant vessel. At least one member of the Harchong crew was down, writhing around on the deck with both hands locked around his right thigh. A splinter wound, Stuart thought. They could be far nastier than they first looked, especially with their tendency to become infected. He hadn't really expected Malden to actually hit the brig. In fact, what he'd wanted was for the first lieutenant to fire across her bow. He started to say something sharp, then stopped and mentally replayed his own instructions.
"Damn, I didn't say across the bow, did I? And I know how enthusiastic James is, too."
He grimaced, but at least the single shot had produced the desired effect. The brig had let fly her sheets, spilling the wind from her sails in token of surrender, and Stuart looked up at his own sails.
"Back the main topsail," he commanded,
and feet pattered across the deck. The main topsail yard swung around, taking the wind to the back, the sail pressing against the mast, and Squall lost speed rapidly. She drifted slowly to leeward, coming down upon her prize while canvas flapped and the bosun marshaled a party to lower the starboard quarterboat while Stewart turned to Captain Barnaby Cates, the commanding officer of Squall's Marine Detachment.
"No nonsense out of them, Barnaby," he said. "We're closer to the shore than I like. Get their wounded man aboard the boat first, then check the cargo. Unless you find something interesting, make sure you've got everyone off and you've got her papers, assuming she's got any, then burn her."
"Aye, sir."
Cates touched his chest in salute, then jerked his head at his first sergeant.
"You heard the captain, sergeant?"
"Aye, aye, sir."
Stewart watched a half-dozen Marines climbing into the boat along with the midshipmen detailed to command it, and the seamen told off as oarsmen. The swinging davits were another new innovation of Sir Dustin Oliver's, and Stewart heartily approved of the concept. They made it far easier and safer to drop a boat, and stowing a ship's boats on davits cleared a lot of precious deck space. The boat hit the water in the galleon's lee, the oars dug in, and the boat went swooping across the steep-sided waves in a cloud of spray and wind. Stewart remembered his own midshipman days and boat trips just like that one, although most of his had been made in what was at least technically a time of peace.
"Well, the lad better get used to it now," the captain thought soberly,
turning and looking back to the south where two columns of smoke climbed into the heavens, announcing that two of the brig's fellow coasters had already been put to the torch.
"Unless I miss my guess, he's going to be my age, at least, before this war's over. But in the meantime..."
He turned his attention back to his own prize, watching his boat go alongside, and shook his head. He felt a solid sense of satisfaction at depriving the group of four and its lackeys of the brig's cargo. Yet he took no pleasure in the thought of destroying the little ship's crew's livelihoods.
"Nothing I can do about that, except see to it they're treated as well as we can until we put them ashore somewhere."
He drew a deep breath, clasped his hands behind him, and began to pace slowly up and down the weather side of the deck. June, Year of God, 894. 1. Royal Palace, City of Manchir, Princedom of Coruscant.
"So, Corin, what do you think this is all about?"
"Father, if I knew that, I'd also know how to read minds, predict weather, choose the winning horse, and figure out where my left sock's gone,"
Sir Corin Garvey replied, and Earl Anvil Rock laughed.
"I think we can probably make at least a few guesses, Rysel,"
Sir Terrell Lecter offered. The Earl of Tartarian sat at one end of the conference table, cleaning his fingernails with the tip of a penknife while he leaned back, comfortably, with the heels of his boots propped on the seat of the chair normally assigned to the Earl of Craggy Hill. Personally, Garvey suspected Tartarian hadn't exactly chosen that particular chair at random.
"Well, in that case, Terrell, guess away," Anvil Rock invited.
"First," Tartarian said, "Captain Athrawes asked to speak to just the four of us, not to the entire council. Second, we all know how close the Sajan is to the Emperor, and unless I miss my guess, the Empress as well. Third, Archbishop Michael isn't going to be present."
He paused, holding up his left hand to admire his nails, and Anvil Rock snorted.
"And those three considerations suggest exactly what to your powerful intellect?"
"I strongly suspect the good captain is going to deliver a message to us," Tartarian replied, looking across his hand at his old friend. "Given the Archbishop's absence, I would also suspect it's a seriously secular message, possibly the sort of thing the Church doesn't want to know about."
"Why do you think he's waited so long to deliver it in that case?"
"That's a bit harder," Tartarian conceded. "On the other hand, we know they've been receiving a steady stream of messages, so it seems most likely this is something he didn't know about until Caleb sent him a dispatch."
"Except, my lord," Sir Charles Doyle put in respectfully from his place beside Garvey,
"that Caleb and Charlian left for Telisburg over a month ago.
which means they're at sea right now, which would make sending any dispatches to Sajan Merlin a bit difficult.
Rash and impetuous youngsters who point out holes in their elders' logic come to bad ends, Tartarian observed, to no one in particular, and Doyle, who wasn't all that many years younger than the Earl, chuckled.
Still, Taral, he has a point, Anvil Rock said.
Of course he does. If he didn't, I'd simply annihilate him with the deadly force of my own logic and be done with it. As it is, I'm forced to admit I have no idea why the Sajan has waited this long to discuss whatever it is with us. There.
He began working on the nails of his other hand.
I've admitted it. I'm fallible.
Be still, my beating heart,
Anvil Rock said tartly, and it was Garvai's turn to laugh. The truth was that none of them had any idea what Captain Athrawis wanted to speak to them about. Except, of course, that Tartarian was almost certainly correct about who the Sajan would be speaking for. On the other hand, the atmosphere in the council chamber was enormously more relaxed and confident than it had been only a few months ago. Garvai still bitterly regretted Father Timon's murder, yet Wyman's decision to have him killed had clearly been the turning point here in Manchir. Garvai wasn't about to issue any overly optimistic proclamations of triumph, but the incidence of violence had plummeted following Wyman's arrest, and the ex-intendant's execution had evoked not protests and riots, but something much closer to a huge sigh of relief. Anti-Karis broadsides were still being tacked up on doors throughout the city. Temple loyalists continued to gather in their own churches, following their own priests. Parties of Carisian Marines continued to draw glowers, even the occasional catcall, but no one actually threw dead cat lizards any longer. In fact, they didn't even throw overripe tomatoes. The Carisian occupation was still a source of resentment, yet most Coruscantians, in the southeast at least, seemed prepared to accept, if only grudgingly, that the Carisians were doing their best to avoid walking all over them. The fact that Viceroy General Cherman had been scrupulous about observing both local law and customary usages wherever possible hadn't hurt. And the fact that the Carisians obviously trusted Garvai's guardsmen to serve as the princedom's primary peacekeeping force hadn't been lost on Coruscantians either. The acid test, in many ways, had come when three Carisian Marines raped a young farm girl. Garvai had gone straight to Cherman, and the Viceroy General's response had been quick and decisive. He'd ordered the suspected rapist's arrest, impaneled a court-martial, and had Garvai's guardsmen bring in the Coruscantian witnesses. The defense counsel's questioning had been sharp, but those witnesses had been given full credence, and the court's verdict had been swift. The Articles of War set only one penalty for forcible rape, and the guilty parties had been marched to the very farm where the crime had taken place for execution. That hadn't been the only incident of swift, impartial justice either. To be fair, there'd been far fewer such incidents than Garvai would have expected. In fact, he was unhappily aware that his own army, when he'd been resisting the Carisian invasion, had committed more crimes against Prince Hector's subjects than the invaders had. There'd been additional infractions, of course. Carisians might be well-behaved, but they were scarcely saints. Theft, looting, the occasional fistfight or beating, and at least two deaths, one of which had clearly been a matter of self-defense on the Carisians' part. Yet the princedom subjects had been forced, many against their will, to concede that the occupation truly was determined to enforce justice and not just Carisian authority.
And then there's Stainer, Garvai thought. That man is scary. It's just not natural. He's a Carisian and a heretic, and I think he could probably talk a slash lizard into eating out of his hand.
His lips twitched a half-smile, yet he wasn't certain the thought was entirely hyperbole. Michael Stainer had never once apologized for the Church of Karis's schismatic fervor.
He'd drawn the line between the Church of Carus and the Temple Loyalists as unflinchingly in every sermon he'd given as in the very first, and no one who'd seen and heard him preach could doubt his unswerving devotion to that schism for a single moment. And yet, for all the adamantine power of his personal faith and bitter defiance of the vicarate and the group of four, he radiated a gentleness, a kindliness, only the most bigoted could deny. Many of those bigots did just that, but Garvey had watched Stainer walk down the nave of cathedrals and churches throughout the capital. He'd seen the foreign archbishop, the apostate heretic, and servant of Shan Wei pause to lay his hand on children's heads, speak to those children's parents, stop entire processions for a word here, a blessing there. It must have been a living nightmare for the people responsible for keeping him alive, because there was no way anyone could have guaranteed there were no hidden daggers in those houses of God. Yet he'd done it anyway. He'd reached out, embraced, welcomed. And everyone in each of those cathedrals and churches had heard the tale of what had happened to him in Telesburg Cathedral. They knew that he knew, from direct and personal experience, how easy it would have been for someone to repeat that attack. And knowing that, still he chose to walk among them, risk exactly that. Archbishops weren't supposed to be like that. They were supposed to be regal. They were supposed to visit their archbishoprics once a year. They might celebrate Mass in the cathedrals adjacent to their palaces, but they didn't go to small churches like St. Catherine's or the Holy Archangels Triumphant. They passed through congregants like the princes of Mother Church they were, not stopping to bounce a baby in their arms, or lay a soothing hand on an ailing toddler, or bestow a gentle blessing on a bereaved widow. They dispensed Mother Church's rulings and justice, and they governed, but they didn't scoop a grubby 6-year-old up in their arms, laughing and tickling, heedless of their exquisitely tailored cassocks, when they went to visit one of Mother Church's orphanages. Coruscant had no idea what to make of him. For that matter, Garvey wasn't certain what to make of Stainer himself. He wasn't accustomed to encountering saints, especially, he thought more grimly, in an archbishop's vestments. Of course he's not a saint. He'd be the very first to insist on that. But until something better comes along... The sound of an opening door pulled him up out of his reflections, and his eyes narrowed as Merlin Athrawis stepped into the council chamber. The sagean crossed to the conference table and bowed courteously. "My knights, thank you for allowing me to speak to you," he said.
"I don't really think there was ever much probability that we wouldn't allow you to speak with us," Anvil Rock said dryly.
"Perhaps not," Merlin smiled. "Still, there are appearances to maintain."
"Indeed there are." Anvil Rock cocked his head thoughtfully. "I'm sure you won't be surprised to discover that we've been speculating amongst ourselves on exactly why it was you wished to speak with us, Sagean Merlin. Am I correct in assuming you're here on the Emperor's and the Empress's business?"
"You are, of course."
"In that case, I suppose we ought to invite you to sit down," the Earl said, pointing at an unoccupied chair across the table from his son and Doyle.
"Thank you, my lord."
Merlin unhooked the scabbard of his katana, laying it on the table in front of him, then sat and folded his hands on the tabletop.
"Very well, Sagean," Anvil Rock invited. "You have our attention."
"Thank you," Merlin repeated, then smiled slightly. "My knights," he began, "by this time, I'm sure, the entire world knows the Emperor has his own personal Sagean bodyguard. As you may have heard, however, I've never actually claimed to be a Sagean. The truth, so far as I know, is that there are no true Sagans in the sense of all the old fables and folktales." He made the admission calmly, and his audience stirred. Anvil Rock leaned forward, one elbow propped on his chair arm, and Tartarian frowned thoughtfully.
"If you go back to the tales of Sagean Cody, for example," Merlin continued, You'll find he's capable of all sorts of magical, mystical feats, from mind-reading to levitation to talking to great lizards. And let's not forget his magic sword and his ability to walk through walls, either. He smiled crookedly. Trust me, my knights, there have been quite a few times I've wished I could walk through walls. Unfortunately, I can't. Yet that isn't to say that there's not a certain core of truth in those fairy tales. His smile vanished. And, while I've never actually claimed to be a Sajan, I have to admit I do have some of the capabilities ascribed to Sajans. As such, the label has a certain applicability, and it provides a convenient handle. Or perhaps it would be better to say a mental pigeonhole people can tuck me into. He paused for a moment, studying his audience, then shrugged. The reason I've brought this up, my knights, is because I may not be so unique as you've assumed. Or to put it another way, there may be more Sajans around than you might have guessed. All of his listeners stiffened. They looked at one another quickly, then leaned towards him as one, and his smile was back, a bit fainter and even more crooked than before. When I first offered my services to King Harald, and then later to Emperor Caleb, it wasn't on a whim, my knights, he told them flatly. I won't pretend I foresaw everything that's happened since, but I did see which way the wind was setting, and I knew where I stood. Yet when I offered Karis my sword, that wasn't all I brought to Telisburg with me, nor did I truly come alone. If it's accurate to call me a Sajan at all, because of the abilities I possess, then I'm not the only Sajan on the face of Safehold.
You're not, Anvil Rock said quietly, when Merlin paused once more.
Of course not, my lord, Merlin shook his head. Of course, even the fables insist not all Sajans are warriors. They may also be counselors, teachers, mentors, even spies.
Yes, they do say that, Doyle said slowly, and Merlin smiled at him.
Indeed they do, Sir Charles. And it happens there are quite a few Sajans right here in Coruscant.
There are?
Anvil Rock sat up very straight, and Merlin nodded.
Yes, my lord. In fact, Sir Corrin's already had evidence of that.
I have I? Garvai considered Merlin across the table.
Assuredly. The Sajan's smile turned into something remarkably like a grin. It came in the form of a rock tossed through your study window.
That was a Sajan?
Garvai's eyebrows rose, and Merlin chuckled.
If I'm a Sajan, that was most definitely a Sajan too, General. This entire princedom's been under observation, my knights, starting even before the Emperor invaded.
He shrugged at their incredulous expressions.
Obviously, not even our network can see everything. If it could, we'd know who ordered Prince Hector's assassination, and we don't.
His unearthly sapphire eyes hardened as he made that admission. Then he inhaled deeply.
We can't see everything, but we see a great deal, and as Sir Corrin can attest, we're quite good at getting information into the hands of the authorities when it seems appropriate. Which is the reason I asked to speak to you today. I've received several reports while here in Coruscant, confirming something their majesties have expected for some time. Since Archbishop Michael is scheduled to leave the princedom at the end of next 5 day, and I'll be leaving with him, my contacts here in Coruscant will probably need to provide information directly to you after I've left, specifically to Sir Charles and Sir Corrin. Since those contacts' effectiveness depends on their anonymity and unobtrusiveness, any reports from them will be in written form, and they'll find their own ways into your hands.
By flying through windows? Garvai asked sardonically, and Merlin chuckled.
We'll try to be a bit less destructive than that, he said.
I hope none of your fellow Sajans come to grief trying to creep through our sentries,
Anvil Rock said a bit tartly. The Earl clearly found the concept of overly clever spies sneaking about in black hooded cloaks less than amusing.
I think that's unlikely to happen, my lord.
You mentioned you've received reports confirming something the Emperor and Empress have been expecting?
Doyle said slowly, and Merlin nodded, his expression sobering.
I have indeed, he said. Specifically, I've received this.
He produced an envelope, laying it on the table in front of him.
All jesting aside, my knights, our agents here in Coruscant have confirmed that Earl Craggy Hill, among others, is engaged in an active conspiracy against both the Empire and this council.
Every face around the table tightened, less in surprise than with tension.
That's a serious charge, Sajan Merlin, Tartarian said after a moment. It would be a serious charge against anyone, against someone of Craggy Hill's stature, not to mention his membership on this council. It becomes extraordinarily so.
Trust me, my lord, their majesties are fully aware of that. Just as they're aware, Craggy Hill isn't acting alone. In fact, he's coordinating with Earl Stormkeep, Earl Deep Hollow, Earl Blackwater, Baron Larchros, Baron Barkor, and at least a dozen other minor knights and landowners. Not to mention quite a few bankers and merchants in northern Coruscant.
His audience was staring at him now, their expressions fixed.
In addition, Bishop Melvin in Barkor, Bishop Executor Thomas, and Amelaine Garnot, the ex-bishop of Larchros, as well as several dozen other temple loyalist clergy, are involved, the majority in violation of their vows to Archbishop Claremont.
The others stared at him for several heartbeats, then exchanged quick glances.
I won't pretend I haven't nourished my own suspicions about some of the people you've just named, Sajan Merlin, Tartarian said then. Coupling them all together, though, he shook his head. That's a pretty hard mouthful to swallow, and to be blunt, it's going to take some extremely solid evidence to convince me to accept it.
I'm sure it will, my lord. And to be honest, I'm relieved it will.
Relieved?
Anvil Rock's expression contained more than a hint of suspicion.
And why might that be, Sajan Merlin? I'd think that if such a serious conspiracy were truly underway, you'd want us to act immediately.
My lord, their majesties have known about this conspiracy literally for months now. Their agents have amassed quite a lot of evidence over that time, and that evidence will be made available to you. However, their majesties have no desire for you to act precipitously or ill-advisedly.
No?
Anvil Rock's eyes narrowed.
The truth is, my lord, that their majesties have deliberately allowed this to go forward without drawing it to your attention. First, because they feared you'd act as immediately and vigorously as is your wont. Normally, that would be a good thing. In this case, however, their majesties, with Prince Narman's advice, preferred to allow the conspirators to fully commit themselves, so that when we do act, there will be no question about their guilt. No room for anyone to legitimately suggest that their majesties or the Regency Council have trumped up the charges as a means of purging the princedom of personal enemies. Secondly, however, there was another factor, another conspirator whose commitment their majesties have been awaiting.
Should we assume the conspirator in question is now committed then, Sajan Merlin?
Doyle asked.
You should, Sir Charles, Merlin said calmly. According to our agents, Grand Duke Zebediah has now pledged to provide modern rifled muskets to the conspirators. Moreover, we have evidence that the rifled muskets in question will be provided by a traitor attached to the Duke of Eastshire's headquarters.
If their expressions had been incredulous before, they were far more disbelieving and shocked this time.
Rifled muskets?
Anvil Rock got out in a half-strangled voice, rearing back in his seat in astonishment.
From Eastshire's own headquarters? Are you telling us the Duke is...
Of course not, my lord.
Merlin waved one hand. I've personally discussed this matter with Duke Eastshire on their Majesty's behalf. His immediate impulse was to order the traitor's immediate arrest. As their Majesty's envoy, however, I was able to talk him out of that.
You were able...
Garvai began, then stopped abruptly, his eyes lighting with speculation. Merlin simply gazed at him for several seconds, until Garvai began shaking his head and leaned back in his chair once more.
So you think they've got enough rope now, do you?
He asked softly. Something along those lines, Merlin acknowledged, with a slight seated bow. The other Coruscantians looked at Garvai, and then Tartarian began to nod.
So, the Emperor and Empress have decided to cut off the Kraken's head, is that it?
The Earl said, and there was a hint, faint but unmistakable, of something very like admiration in his tone.
Precisely, my lord, Merlin shrugged.
Grand Duke Zebediah's agent in Duke Eastshire's headquarters is unaware we've been very carefully tracking the rifles he thinks he's managed to lose. We've followed them every step of the way, from the manufactories in Old Carus to Chisholm, and we can establish, with both witnesses and written testimony, the exact point at which he diverted them from the Imperial Army depots for which they were bound. Other of our agents have been tracking his correspondence with Grand Duke Zebediah, just as we've become aware of certain documentary evidence in Earl Craggy Hill's possession, proving Zebediah's involvement. It's their Majesty's intention to allow those rifled muskets to be delivered here in Coruscant. When that happens, you'll be informed, as will Viceroy General Cherman. At that time, the Viceroy General, on their Majesty's behalf, will request your assistance in moving against the conspirators. The Imperial Navy will provide sea lift to transport your forces, supported by the Viceroy General's Marines, to arrest the conspirators and seize the weapons and other evidence.
Langhorne,
Anvil Rock said softly. He looked more than moderately stunned. Tartarian, on the other hand, wore a remarkably evil-looking smile.
I never did like Zebediah, he remarked, and Craggy Hill's been a pain in the arse from the instant Prince Hector was assassinated.
And I can't say it breaks my heart that Barkor's up to his cowardly arse in all of this,
Garvai observed almost dreamily.
Mine either,
Doyle said rather more grimly, reaching down to massage the leg, which had been half-crippled at Harrell's Crossing. The four Coruscantians looked at one another, and Merlin sat back in his own chair to let them think. After several minutes of silent introspection, their attention returned, one by one, to him.
May I ask how long their Majesties, and let's not forget Prince Narmon, have been allowing this little plot to simmer?
Tartarian asked finally.
From the moment they found out about it, Merlin replied. I suppose I should admit, though, that we've been keeping an especially sharp eye on Grand Duke Zebediah from the very beginning.
Of course you have,
Anvil Rock snorted.
Anybody but a blind, drooling idiot, which, by the way, Emperor Caleb has amply demonstrated he isn't, would be watching him with both eyes. Why do I have the distinct feeling, Sajan Merlin, that this proof of Zebediah's treason didn't exactly devastate their Majesties?
Tartarian inquired.
Partly, I suppose, because it scarcely came as a surprise, my lord,
Merlin said.
And also, I suspect, because they're rather relieved to get it out of the way as soon as possible.
He shrugged.
The way the Emperor put it, the question was never whether or not Zebediah would betray his oaths, but simply a matter of when. That being the case, their Majesties are quite happy to have unambiguous, demonstrable proof of his treachery.
And the same thing's true here in Coruscant, isn't it?
Anvil Rock's eyes were shrewd.
And the same thing is true here in Coruscant, yes, my lord.
Merlin met the Earl's gaze levelly.
I realize many of the people who have been party to this conspiracy consider themselves patriots. In their position, I might feel the same way. Not all of them do, however, and whether they do or not, their majesties propose to levy the most severe penalties only upon those who have betrayed their own sworn oaths. I'm not suggesting everyone else involved will get off scot-free, because they won't. But I believe you've seen in Viceroy General Cherman's approach to the disturbances here in Manchir and the surrounding lands the proof that their majesties have no desire to be bloody despots. Punishment will be meted out only in accord with law, and where practical, compassion will have a voice in sentencing. Hopefully, at the end of the day, we'll be able to, as Earl Tartarian put it, cut off the Kraken's head in a single blow, without a pitched battle and with a minimum of bloodshed. Their majesties want all of the traitors, my knights, but one reason they want them is to ensure we won't have to do this again and again. Merlin looked back at the Coruscandians, his blue eyes steady. Caleb and Charlian aren't Jaspar Clinton. They take no pleasure in cruelty or blood. But they are determined to put an end to this business once and for all, because, you may be certain, men like Craggy Hill and Zebediah and Barkor aren't planning on shedding their blood in the name of Coruscandian independence. They're planning on shedding other people's blood in the name of their own power, and their majesties have no intention of letting them do that. 2. Off Dragon Island, Hanky Sound, Kingdom of Dolar.
Well, at least we've found them, Captain Arnold Stewart told himself. Of course, figuring out what to do with them now that we have is another problem.
Stewart smiled thinly, then grimaced as the leading Dolaran galleon fired another broadside. His own squall, bringing up the rear of the abbreviated, very abbreviated, Carizian battle line, had yet to engage, and it was going to be a while yet, unfortunately, before she could. The late morning sun was hot, burning down on the blue waters of Hanky Sound, the southern lobe of the Gulf of Dolar, and the green slopes of Dragon Island to the east, but the stiff breeze out of the northwest was brisk, almost chill. It piled up 9 or 10 foot waves, and the copper-bottomed squall forged along on her southeasterly heading at almost 7 knots under topgallants and single-reefed topsails, with the wind fine on her larboard quarter. The Dolaran ships, holding their course to the southwest on the starboard tack as the two forces slowly converged, had the wind nearly abeam. It was close to their best point of sailing, yet they were making no more than 6 knots. Unfortunately, they were between the Carizians and their intended prey, and there were 5 of them. 3 of the Dolarans were already in action with HMS Dart, leading the Carizian formation. Captain John Powell, Dart's skipper and the senior officer present, was a veteran of Rock Point, Crag Reach, and Darko Sound, and his ship was one of Sir Gwilym Manthir's newest vessels. Dart was actually 5.5 feet longer than Empress of Karas, Emperor Caleb's preferred flagship, yet she mounted 10 fewer guns. Sir Dustin Oliver had come to the conclusion that Empress of Karas was going to be overgunned, too heavily laden for her displacement, even before she'd been completed. The fact that she'd quickly begun to hog after she came into service, her keel bending upward amidships because of the heavy weights bearing down on the ends of her hull, had only confirmed his initial fears. Her powerful broadside had made her a fearsome foe, yet once it became obvious his concerns had been well-placed, there'd been little choice but to reduce her armament. Having seen the problem coming, however, he'd taken pains to avoid it when he designed the Sword of Karas-class ships, and in addition to reducing weights and increasing displacement, he'd experimented with diagonal planking as a means of further increasing her longitudinal strength. As a result, Dart carried her designed armament with ease. She mounted the same number of 30-pounders as Empress of Karas, but only 20 carronades, and the additional length on the gun deck seemed to have produced a higher rate of fire. And although she carried fewer of them, her carronades threw 57-pound round shot instead of 30-pound shot, which actually increased her weight of broadside. She also carried her guns slightly higher, and her scantlings were thicker. All of that made her the ideal ship to be leading the Carisian line at this particular moment, but it didn't change the fact that she was engaged against three enemy vessels. HMS Shield, darts next astern, would be able to come to her assistance in the next 10 or 15 minutes, but Squall had been detached up to windward when the enemy was spotted. Her merchant ship origins also made her, little though Stewart liked admitting it, the slowest sailor of the three, and she'd lost ground on her consorts during the pursuit. It was evident she was still faster than the Dolaran galleons, yet on their present courses she was at least 40 minutes, more likely an hour, from any range at which she could engage. On the other hand, the two rearmost vessels in the Dolaran formation lagged almost as badly.
"But they're not supposed to be keeping formation this well," Stewart realized his own thoughts sounded plaintive, almost petulant. "Sir Gwilym told us Thirsk was the most dangerous fellow on the other side, but this is ridiculous."
It was mostly a fluke that they'd encountered this convoy in the first place. Captain Powell's detachment had been cruising off the northeast coast of Shui Province's Harris Peninsula, looking for shipping in the waters between Parrot Point to the north and Sandy Head to the south. They'd had reports that foundries in Shui were shipping guns to the Dolaran yards in Gorath, and Sir Gwilym had posted Powell to intercept that traffic. They'd intercepted five small brigs which had, indeed, been laden with Harchong-cast bronze artillery, and Captain Powell had found prize crews to send them back to Claw Island. He disliked giving up the men for those crews, but their cargo of guns had been too potentially valuable not to send them in. After that, though, there'd been almost a full 5 day of boring inactivity before Lieutenant Commander Showale, in the 10-gun schooner Flash, on the eastern flank of Powell's formation, had spotted topsails further to the east. That had been the evening before, and they'd gone in pursuit, chasing all through the night by moonlight, and with Squall slowly falling yet further astern. Now, the better part of 30 hours later, they'd finally overtaken the convoy, and the Dolaran galleons had peeled off and turned to place themselves between the pursuers and the merchantmen.
"Showell never would have spotted them if not for the escorts," Stewart thought now. "The merchant ship's masts were too short to sight until we got closer."
The fact that the galleons had betrayed the convoy's presence might turn out to have been something of a mixed blessing, however. All the Dolaran warships were larger than Squall. None were as large as Dart or Shield, perhaps, yet Stewart's best estimate was that they carried at least 200 guns to the truncated Carisian squadron's 144. The Dolaran weapons were probably lighter, yet that was still a considerable disparity. At the moment, Flash and her slightly larger sister Mace were both off sliding around the Dolaran galleon's rear. The pair of galleys assigned to the coaster's close protection were new, bigger, and more powerful than anything Dolar had taken to Armageddon Reef, but Stewart doubted they'd be any match for the nimble, well-handled schooner's carronade broadsides. Unfortunately, between the galleys and the galleons, it was likely most of the coasters would escape if they scattered soon enough. Each schooner might be able to run down two of them, possibly even three, if they disposed of the galleys quickly enough, but there were 14 of them. If Squall and her galleon consorts had been able to lend a hand, the entire convoy would undoubtedly have been obliterated. Which wasn't going to happen now. Captain Caetano Raisando smiled in fierce satisfaction as HMS Rockerai's starboard broadside thundered again. His gunners probably weren't being as accurate as he might have liked, but they were maintaining an impressive rate of fire, especially for a ship's company which had never before seen battle. He could have wished he had the weather gauge instead of being forced to engage from leeward, but at least he was to windward of the convoy. He'd been tempted to detach HMS Prince of Dolar, his rearmost galleon, to assist the galleys assigned to the coaster's close escort. Unfortunately, Prince of Dolar couldn't have gotten there before the infernally fast, Shanwei-damned Carizian schooners. By the same token, however, all five of Rysando's ships were between the Carizian galleons and the convoy, and he was satisfied none of them were going to break past him to assist in the merchant ship's massacre. Not without fighting their way through, at any rate. And the truth is, even if I am never going to admit it to a single soul, that pounding two or three Carizian galleons into driftwood would be worth the loss of the entire convoy. As a converted merchantman, Rockerai lacked poop deck of the Dolaran Navy's purpose-built galleons. As a result, her wheel, quarterdeck guns, and officers were completely exposed to overhead fire. On the other hand, it meant Rysando had, at least in theory, a clear view as he stood by the starboard rail, gazing towards the enemy. Unfortunately, he was also staring directly into the choking bank of evil-smelling powder smoke rolling back across Rockerai's decks on the wind. That was another problem with being to leeward. Not only did his gunners have to cope with their own smoke blowing straight back into their faces, but the Carizian artillery smoke came driving down across them as well. The wind was brisk enough to clear their own smoke quickly, actually, but there were always fresh clouds of Carizian smoke to replace it. All they could really make out were their targets' masts above the seething, stinking fog bank, and that couldn't contribute to their accuracy. Another Carizian broadside came smashing back. They seemed to be firing a bit more slowly, but they were scoring an unpleasant number of hits. And each of those hits did substantially more damage than Rysando estimated his own lighter pieces were accomplishing. He'd expected 30-pounders, even 35-pounders, from Earl Thirsk's reports of Crag Reach, and he hadn't looked forward to the disparity in weight of metal. Unfortunately, at least some of his present opponent's guns were even heavier than that, and he winced as one of his own quarterdeck 12-pounders took a direct hit. The round shot came screaming in through the bulwark gunport at just enough of an angle to chew a perfectly rounded half-moon out of the forward edge of the open port's frame. It slammed into the gun carriage, apparently at a slightly rising angle, and struck the underside of the 12-pounder's barrel. The ton-and-a-half bronze gun tube erupted upward, leaping out of the explosion of splintered carriage timbers and shattered ring bolts like a sounding doom whale. Half the 8-man crew was killed as the enormous round shot slashed directly through them. Two of the four survivors were crushed and broken as the barrel of their own weapon crashed back down on top of them. Something, probably a splinter, possibly a broken iron bolt, hissed by Rysando's right ear, close enough to make his head ring, as if someone had just slapped him, hard. "Another inch or two and I wouldn't have to worry about anything ever again," he thought, then brushed the thought aside as he contemplated the carnage that single hit had left in its wake. "Probably one of those damned carronades," he reflected grimly. At least they knew what the Carizians called the shorter, stubbier guns, but that didn't help a lot when the temple had decreed that all of Mother Church's galleons would be equipped solely with long guns. In some ways, Rysando actually agreed with Vicar Elaine's logic. The carronades clearly had a shorter maximum range than a long gun of the same bore, and the ability to pound the enemy and kill his crews before he got into range to return the compliment had a great deal to recommend it. There were, unfortunately, a few flaws in that logic. For one thing, Earl Thirsk was right about the two sides' relative seamanship. Much though Rysando hated to admit it, a Coruscantian admiral was far more likely to achieve the engagement range he wanted than a Dolaran admiral was to prevent him from doing so. Even ignoring that, however, Vicar Elaine seemed to be still thinking in terms of conventional boarding actions, despite the logical disconnect between them and the greater range he wanted from his longer guns. He seemed more interested in larger numbers of lighter guns, suitable for sweeping an opponent's decks just before closing to board, than in smaller numbers of heavier guns capable of smashing their way through an enemy ship's timbers at longer ranges. Killing the other fellow's crewmen was all well and good, in Rysando's opinion, but boarding actions had clearly become secondary, at best, to artillery duels. And, in an artillery duel, if the other fellow's gunners were protected by heavy bulwarks your artillery couldn't penetrate, he was going to be far better placed to kill your personnel than you were to kill his.
"Oh, stop complaining, Caetano," he scolded himself. "You've still got more guns than they do, and more ships than they do, and it's time you concentrated on what you're going to do to them instead of what they're going to do to you."
"Let her fall off a quarter point," he shouted to the helmsman.
Captain Jean Powell watched the leading Doloran galleon's masts as the other ship altered course slightly. He was turning a bit further away, and Powell would have liked to think that meant he'd had enough. Unfortunately,
"He's just giving himself a little more range until his friends get here," Powell thought harshly. "Not exactly what I expected. They were supposed to either run the hell away or come in as a mob, like they did at Rock Point and Darko Sound."
Powell began to pace slowly up and down, well clear of the recoiling carronades. The range had fallen to a bit over 200 yards, well within the 57-pounder's effective range, and he bared his teeth as he contemplated what those massive shot must be doing to their targets. But the fierce grin faded slightly as the enemy's fire continued slamming back. They weren't especially accurate, those gunners over there, but they were damnably persistent. It was the first time Powell had faced an actual broadside, and he was frankly astonished by how steadily the Dolorans were standing up. The sheer weight of Carizian fire had broken the morale of ship after ship at Rock Point and Darko Sound, but it wasn't doing that this time.
"Or not from this range, at least," he told himself, and looked astern where Harris I. Wayne's shield was coming up fast.
With all the smoke, he could no longer see Squall's sails, but she had to be somewhere behind shield. He hoped she was, at any rate. The two leading Dolorans continued to pound away at Dart, but the third and fourth enemy galleons were beginning to fire on shield. I. Wayne wasn't firing back yet, though. He was clearly reserving his own first broadside until he reached the range he wanted, assuming he got there.
"Bring her a point to larboard,"
Captain Powell snapped. Captain Stewart watched the mast tops poking up out of the boil of smoke as Dart's head came a bit further north, moving the wind around to almost dead astern as Powell moved to prevent the enemy from holding the range open. Stewart approved, although he wished the other captain had waited a bit longer and let Squall get closer before he'd done it. Shield foamed steadily along in her consort's wake, and he still had a clear view of Captain Iwane's ship through his spyglass. As a result, he could see the white feathers leaping from the wave slopes like sudden fountains as the Dolorans began to fire at Shield. From the scattered appearance of those feathers, the enemy's gunners weren't overly blessed with accuracy, but there were obviously a lot of them. Even as that thought crossed his mind, a hole punched itself abruptly through Shield's main topsail. The range from Shield to the closest Doloran galleon was down to 200 yards at the most, Stewart thought, and wondered how much longer I. Wayne was going to wait. Harris I. Wayne looked up as the round shot punched through Shield's main topsail with the sound of a giant slapping fist. She'd taken at least three more hits on her way in, but so far there was no report of casualties. Shield was a shorter, stubbier ship than Dart, a sister of HMS Dreadnought. the very first galleon designed as warship from the keel up. She carried the same number of guns as Dart, although her battery was more cramped than the later larger ships, and her carronades were only 30-pounders, and she was a bit slower under most conditions. Her frames and timbers, though, were heavier than those of any converted merchantman, and they'd stood up well to the handful of hits the Dolorans had so far achieved.
"Looks like Commodore Seamount was right about their powder being weaker than ours,"
Iwane thought.
"Of course it doesn't hurt that their guns are lighter to boot."
He knew at least some of the Dolaran artillery was lighter at any rate. All he had to do was peek over the hammock nettings and look down at the 12-pound shot, standing half-buried in his ship's side, just forward of her number 27 gunport. He doubted any of his own 30-pound shot would fail to penetrate when the time came.
"Of course, as we get closer, they'll start punching through too," he reflected. "That will be unpleasant."
He looked across at the nearest Dolaran. The range was coming down on 100 yards, and he heard a sudden scream from below decks as at least one Dolaran shot finally got through. He didn't know whether it had penetrated Shield's timbers or come through an open gunport, but whichever it had done, he didn't doubt he was going to start taking more casualties very soon.
"Stand to, the larboard battery!" he shouted to Motukai Daikar, his first lieutenant.
Sir Darrand Rosail glowered into the blinding smoke as it cascaded back across HMS Grand Vicar Maris. He stood on the starboard poop deck ladder, 3 feet above the level of his quarterdeck, trying to see across the netted hammocks, which formed a, hopefully, musket-proof barrier along the rail. At the moment, the stinking tide of smoke that spewed out with each broadside rendered his efforts to see anything more or less useless. Rosail's 50-gun ship was one of the first of the Royal Dolaran Navy's new construction galleons, and he'd been more than a little surprised when he received command of her. He'd never made any secret of his personal allegiance to Duke Thorast, and he shared the Duke's dislike for the Earl of Thirsk to the full, if not for all the same reasons. Although Rosail was never going to forget all he owed to Thorast's patronage, he couldn't deny, in the privacy of his own thoughts, that Thirsk had clearly been right, and Duke Malachi had obviously been wrong before Rock Point. Anyone with the least awareness of how court politics worked knew it would have been foolish to expect Thorast to commit the disastrous folly of admitting his brother-in-law's stupidity had pissed away almost the entire peacetime navy, yet even the Duke must know it was true. Rosail did, at any rate. For that matter, the captain was willing to admit the advantages of the signal flags Thirsk had copied from the damned Carizians. The degree of control, of the ability to communicate between ships they provided, was priceless, and he shuddered to think of how things might have worked out if it had remained a Carizian monopoly. In fact, he'd been forced to concede Thirsk had a clearer, more realistic view than Thorast in almost every respect of the kinds of ships and tactics needed to knock those arrogant Carizian bastards back on their heels. All that was true, and Rosail knew it. But he also knew the Earl was systematically gutting the Navy in the process. He was promoting commoners over nobles, insisting gentlemen had to accept schooling from uncouth, low-born merchant seamen like Ondair Crawl of the Bedard. He was undermining discipline with his foolish restrictions on how it could be enforced. And this madness of his, requiring a seaman's wage be paid directly to his family, if that was his choice when he was at sea. And that it had to be paid in full and on time. Rosail had no objection to paying the men their wages, eventually. But money was always tight. Sometimes decisions had to be made about where to spend limited funds, and seamen aboard a warship didn't have anything to spend money on,
which made not paying them until the end of the commission a reasonable way to husband scanty funds. Of course, sometimes they couldn't be paid immediately after a ship paid off anyway, but there were always brokers willing to buy up their delayed wages for a 20% commission or so. And if a man got himself killed at sea, which was bound to happen fairly frequently, the Navy didn't have to pay anyone, now did it? But not according to Thirsk. Even without the insanity of lifetime pensions for widows and orphans, insisting wages be paid immediately to a man's family was going to play hell with the Navy's finances in the fullness of time. Mother Church might be able to afford it, but there was no way the Kingdom of Dolar could continue the practice once the heretics were crushed. And who was going to end up being blamed and hated by the common lower-deck scum when it had to be abandoned? Not Earl Thirsk, that was for certain. No, it would be left to Duke Thorast to clean up the mess, and they'd be lucky if they avoided mutinies in the process. And when that happens, the way Thirsk's cut the balls off Navy discipline isn't going to help one bit either, Rosail thought grimly. The lash can't make a bad seaman good, but it can make a good seaman bad indeed. The lash is all most of them really understand. The way Thirsk's sucking up to them is going to leave all of us even deeper in the shit when it comes time to clean up behind him. But this wasn't the time to pick fights with the man Vicar Elaine and Vicar Jaspar had selected to command the Dolaran Navy. That time would come once the disastrous consequences of Thirsk's more outlandish policies became apparent, and Rosail was rather looking forward to that day of comeuppance. In the meantime, though, there was a war to fight, and as insane as Earl Thirsk might be, in altogether too many ways, at least he understood what had to be done if that war was going to be won. Grand Vicar Morris heaved as she blasted yet another broadside into the smoke, and Rosail smiled thinly as he pictured what that torrent of iron must be doing to its target. "I wish I could see the damned thing," he admitted to himself. "Still, I can see the masts, and the rest of the frigging ship has to be somewhere under them." He snorted in harsh amusement at the thought, and climbed the rest of the way up the ladder to the poop deck. He'd be more exposed from there, but maybe he could actually see something up to windward.